If the people we love are stolen from us, the way to have them live on is to never stop loving them. James O'Barr, from his novel, The Crow. Welcome back to Dead and Gone in Wyoming, a monthly podcast telling the stories of this remarkable state's most enduring murders and disappearances. I'm Scott Fuller, and coming up on this month's episode, what circumstances might conspire to tear a mother away from her children? There may be no stronger bond among our species, but sadly there are stronger forces. Someone wiser than me once said, it's easier to be a great person than a good one. Put another way, it's ultimately more important to be good than great. We aren't comfortable speaking ill of the dead, which has always fascinated me a little bit. While a person is alive, we're relatively free with our thoughts and feelings about a person's composition, their actions, words, how they make us feel, be it positive or negative. But when a person passes away, our remarks about the departed abruptly change, don't they? A person who had trouble meeting obligations in life becomes a free spirit in death. The rude or the blunt when they were alive transform into someone who wasn't afraid to tell it like it was after they've died. What is that about? Common manners alone would seem to imply that we should all behave the opposite of that. If there's a need to speak ill of a person at all, wouldn't it seem more logical anyway to offer them compliments while they were alive, or conversely, whitewash their shortcomings while the person is alive to hear them or to hear about them? I think that contradiction essentially boils down to one word: legacy. We will all of us one day no longer be here, no longer be alive. This is irrefutable and unchangeable, as ever. And one of the ways that we've learned to cope with that reality is through the concept of legacy. When we are no longer able to live on, our accomplishments and our impacts on the world will. In one sense, this is sort of silly, but it's also practically true. So long as people are talking about you, some part of you remains alive in some way. Conversely, there comes a time when, if people stop talking about you, it's as though you never existed at all. As an example, name for me, if you can, George Washington's brother. Odds are you can't. Odds are you can't name any of George Washington's 9 siblings. Some of them, by the way, fairly accomplished in their own rights. Maybe this is part of the reason why we've become so obsessed with accomplishment in recent centuries, and so obsessed with fame in recent decades. But the truth is, there won't be many George Washingtons, hardly any, actually. Such enduring infamy is exceedingly rare. And yet we chase that legacy through greatness, don't we? Build the highest, earn the most, give the most, be the best. Greatness is the shortest path to legacy. But greatness is not legacy's truest form, I don't believe. That's not to say that greatness isn't great. All greatness, Washingtonian or not, is important. Greatness means that you've meant something to most people. Goodness means that you've meant a great deal to a few people. Goodness is much more difficult than greatness, and it's a great deal more important. The next time you hear someone being eulogized after they pass away, pay attention to those words. Is the person being described as great or good? A business partner might be more likely to describe somebody as great after they've died, thinking of all those accomplishments together in the boardroom. A family member, a spouse, might say he was a good man. The good person's kindness and generosity and forgiveness, while they were alive, will stay with those few people for the rest of their lives. Goodness can be passed on for generations. Greatness will crumble. Being good and great aren't always mutually exclusive, but they often are. You will choose at some various times in your life, sometimes every day, between greatness and goodness. It's my own view that a parent should not be remembered by their children as being great for their accomplishments. A parent should be remembered by their children as being good. This is the story of not a great mother, but a good one. The Wyoming Highway Patrol found the vehicle on August 12, 2004. It was an exceptionally cool day for midsummer. A dry breeze, like sandpaper, washed over the high desert plains, and Renee Yeargain's abandoned Subaru station wagon sat in glinting whites in the rest stop parking lot, almost as though it could be waiting for its owner to return at any moment. The rest area off the Can-Am Highway between Torrington and Casper is a traveler's oasis from the endless rolling plains. Spotted with occasional trees, just off the Horse Creek Valley, it's a stop far enough off the two-lane highway to be partially hidden from the main road, but it's also well-used during the summer, especially as a practical midway point on State Highway 85 northeast of Cheyenne and south of Torrington. Many a weary highway traveler has briefly visited the Merion Highway 85 rest stop, and many a highway patrolman. The 87 station wagon with the keys left inside was registered to the mother of a 24-year-old woman named Renee Yeargain. The state trooper ran the vehicle and the owner, but found nothing unusual in the system pertaining to either the Subaru, Renee, or her mother, the car's owner. The patrolman noted the abandoned vehicle as well as the unusual circumstances of the keys and some other possessions being left inside the unlocked car. But as of August 12, 2004, nothing else was wrong, at least nothing that police had been made aware of. The vehicle hadn't been reported stolen. The owner of the vehicle didn't have any outstanding warrants. Nothing of investigative significance had at that point been reported in connection to this car that was sitting in the parking lot of a rest stop in the middle of the high desert. But there would be something significant about this car. The patrolman knew that instinctively, especially when he noted what appeared to be some strange markings on the outside of the vehicle. Couldn't be sure, but it was almost like someone had tried to set the car on fire while it sat there. Renee Yeargain's own car hadn't been operational for some time at this point, and so she had most likely been the driver of the car. Her mom had been letting her drive it. Renee lived with her four children in Torrington, in a house that was far too small for that many, near the North Platte River. But Renee felt grateful. That's because Renee had a past that people usually prefer to put behind them. She became pregnant at 15 years old. Her family says she'd had issues with drugs in the past. Her addiction, at one point, had temporarily lost her custody of her children. But those close to Renee in 2004 say she had recently turned a corner. Her children were out of foster care and back living with her. And Renee had recently developed professional ambitions as well. She was finally on track to get paid for doing what she loved, maybe even full-time. She had obtained a tattoo license and planned to begin operating her own business out of her home, hopefully sometime soon. In the meantime, Renee took what work she could find in the area. She had a job at a restaurant just over the state line in Nebraska. She was also working in a tattoo parlor there, among other jobs in Nebraska and Wyoming. Renee's boyfriend of 3 years, then 23-year-old Josh Minter, had moved in with Renee after leaving his family's property in a rural area outside of town near the Nebraska border. At that time that the Wyoming Highway Patrolman found the abandoned car at the rest stop, with the keys and the cell phone and the purse with a wallet inside but no money, at that time Josh Minter was one of the only people who'd known that something, at least, was off. Josh said that 3 days before, on August 9th, Renee had disappeared. Apparently she'd left him, their home together, and her four children. Then, not knowing where Renee was or what to do with the kids now, Josh said he took the three oldest children to the foster families where they'd lived previously. The youngest child, an infant, he kept to care for himself. That child was Renee's and Josh's together. The next day, August 10, 2004, Josh called the Department of Family Services to let them know where the older children were. He apparently did not call the police. And so when the WHP found Renee's car 2 days after that, she had not yet been reported missing. But that would change the very next day. On August 13, 2004, Renee's mother marched into the Torrington Police Department and told the chief of police that she hadn't spoken to her daughter in a few days and she was worried about Renee. And given Renee's past, and given that Renee was the primary caregiver to four children, including an infant, Renee's mother told the chief that to not hear from her daughter over any significant period of time was highly unusual. Torrington PD opened their missing persons case on Renee Yergain that same day. One of the first things they learned about was that station wagon, the car that the 24-year-old mother had been driving, how it was found at the rest stop 40 miles outside of town 3 days before. They were disturbed, to say the least, to find Renee's abandoned vehicle had contained her most vital personal items, the keys, the wallet, the phone. But investigators were also intrigued by what was not found in the car. There was no sign of Renee's tattoo kit, which she used almost every day. Nor were there any clothes found in the vehicle. It was as if Renee had parked her car at the rest stop and left her entire life behind, taking nothing with her but the money in her wallet and the clothes on her back, and her tattoo kit. Investigators sent a fax containing Renee's photo and other information to the Rocky Mountain Information Bulletin, which covered the surrounding states. If Renee turned up anywhere in the region, Torrington police would get a heads up. And at that point, 72 hours or so after Renee had been last seen, there was still every chance in the world of that happening, especially considering who their missing person was. Victimology in a missing person's case can become complicated quickly. For example, establishing a behavioral baseline for Renee Yergain. Apart from her history of drug use and subsequent attempts to turn her life around for the sake of her kids and herself, Renee further had a history of mental illness. Her family says she had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. This would cause Renee periods of days or weeks of depression, when other times she might experience days-long symptoms of abnormal energy or happiness. In other words, by clinical definition, establishing a normal pattern of behavior for Renee Yergain is practically impossible. Investigators were also aware that her mental condition made her significantly more likely than average to harm herself. We've gained significant understanding of bipolar disorder in recent years, and we now know that as a 24-year-old, Renee Yergain was approaching the typical onset age for her disease. Renee, though, had been suffering bipolar symptoms for years before. She'd been taking medication for it by her early 20s. But Renee's family found it strange, beyond strange, really, that she might have abandoned her life in Torrington. She unquestionably loved her children first and foremost. Citing the efforts and sacrifices she'd made to get her kids back, she told friends that her life had turned around. She was again pursuing her passion, tattooing. And to those around her, she seemed excited to see what was coming next. And things seemed to be going well with her boyfriend, Josh, too. According to some who knew Renee, things had been going very well, actually, which hadn't always been the case in Renee's life. To say that Renee Yergain had been unlucky in love would not acknowledge a lifetime's worth of romantic heartbreak and tragedy she'd experienced in just a few short years of romantic dating. In another state, in almost a different lifetime, Renee had been previously engaged, but her first fiancé had died in a motorcycle accident. His death, according to those close to Renee, played a large part in the mental illness and drug abuse issues that would follow Renee in the ensuing years. These issues were compounded when, back in Wyoming in 1997, a close friend, if not something more of Renee's, was also killed in a car crash near Douglas. Renee had very suddenly lost two men who were important to her, at least one of whom she'd had romantic attachments to, in just a few years, and at the very inauguration of her adulthood. But a few years later, and with a new boyfriend, to most it seemed like Renee was bent on some version of the American dream. She was closer to her family than ever, emotionally and geographically. And in Josh Minter, Renee had another man in her life who was willing to help. Not just help, but after a few years of seeing Renee, he was apparently willing to have and to hold, too. Renee's mother said that just a week before Renee went missing, she'd called her mom to share the news that she and Josh Minter were to be married, and soon. In 3 weeks, Renee had told her mother. Short notice, to say the least, Renee's ceremony was to be held on August 22, 2004. Renee disappeared 12 days before the wedding date. Josh Minter told police he'd been at Renee's home with all four children when she left late on August 9th at about midnight. He said she left in the Subaru and simply never came home. She'd been wearing jeans, a black tank top with a red heart on it with a bug in the corner. Josh said that Renee had said something about meeting some bikers for tattoo work to make some extra cash. But according to Josh, she didn't say where she was going. Josh told police that she walked out the door carrying a grocery sack with some clothes in it. And Josh said the next day, when she hadn't come home, he started calling around to Renee's family and friends, asking if they'd seen her or knew where she was. According to Renee's mother, Josh Minter called her, too. She said Josh told her that Renee had left the house on foot on the night of August 9th, leaving the car, and that she returned to get the car the following day. That is not what Josh apparently told the police. He told them he'd seen Renee walk out the door and never come back. But Renee's mother said he told her he'd seen her one more time. And that's not the only discrepancy apparent in Josh Minter's reported account of events from August 9, 2004. From an article in the Casper Star Tribune published the following spring, quote, an investigator on the case said it was reported that Minter had said he was home with all the children when Yergin left on August 9th. Then, two paragraphs later in the same news story, quote, asked who was home on the night of her disappearance, Minter said the older children were at a friend's house for the night. The baby was at his mother's home. So where are Renee Yergin's four children on the night of August 9th, 2004? In one version, all of them are at the house. In another, none of them are at the house. This is not as though one media outlet reported one thing and another outlet reported something else. This is a contradiction coming from the same newspaper article. In the same newspaper. And that one single newspaper article, by the way, is basically the only statewide coverage that Renee's disappearance ever received. Renee's mother, Diane Van Horn, further claimed that Josh Minter had gotten rid of all of Renee's belongings in the home by August 13th. That was the same day that Renee's mom reported her missing to Torrington PD. Even so, initially, Renee's closest family members, who were her mother and her sister, believed that she might really have just walked away, metaphorically speaking anyway. There was no denying the unpredictable behavior of Renee's past. But would she really leave her children, who she'd faced so many personal demons to get back into her life, and her back in theirs? Would she leave an infant baby, for that matter? Would she leave the baby's father, her fiancé? As time went by through the fall, with Thanksgiving and Christmas passing with time, Renee's family came to a firm realization that something terrible had happened to her. She had not left on her own, not without calling for this long. But her husband-to-be and boyfriend of 3 years saw things differently. Josh Minter stated publicly that Renee had gone back to drinking and that she was using drugs again. He said she'd recently been having trouble with the children, too, and money had always been tight for the couple, adding to their stress. As for the two of them, Josh acknowledged that there had been disagreements leading up to the wedding as well. According to Josh, Renee wanted to plan a large, formal wedding. Josh told her they simply couldn't afford it. He countered the couple could just head off to Vegas and get it done on the cheap. Josh himself said this idea didn't fly at all with Renee. He told the Casper Star Tribune, quote, that really bugged her. I guess she just wanted the big wedding. She's a tough girl. I'm sure she's okay. She just doesn't want to deal with anything right now. End quote. During the course of any missing persons case, especially as it goes unsolved for a period of time, tips start coming in. Claims of knowledge, sightings of the missing, psychic revelations even, etc. And Renee Yergin's disappearance was no different. According to Torrington's chief at the time, Torrington police received over 100 tips in this case. Likely most of those tips didn't come in until 8 months after Renee disappeared. That's because the very first statewide mention of Renee's case in surviving newspaper archives came in May 2005. Not August 2004, not September. In October, it went uncovered. November, December, January, and February went by with no statewide media coverage of Renee's disappearance until May. Usually, it's the other way around. There's a blast of coverage after a person goes missing, which tapers off after several months. Here it was the opposite, well, sort of the opposite. There was no coverage for 8 months, and then there were a few stories, a couple of follow-ups over the years, and that's it. But why did it take so long for Renee's case to get any coverage outstate in Wyoming? Likely several reasons, but one of them is revealed in that initial May 2005 coverage from the Casper Star Tribune. This is 8 months after Renee had disappeared. Torrington's police chief at the time overtly stated in that article, he believed that Renee Yeargain had left Torrington on her own free will. What happened when she got to that rest stop, 40 miles away, that might be another story, he said. After 5 years, concerned that Renee's case would go cold if it hadn't already, one of her friends started a MySpace page to raise awareness in 2008. Yeah, MySpace. Over time, that page would change hands and now exists on Facebook. And it's now run by one of Renee's former coworkers, who posted the following update just a few weeks ago, quote, "Today I had the pleasure of sitting down with Torrington Police Chief Matt Johnson and the lead detective on Renee's case. They have informed me that the case still remains open, and they still do get leads and calls about Renee. They also stated that before anything can happen with Renee's case, they need more solid leads." End quote. Perhaps police hadn't taken Renee Yeargain's case seriously as a possible involuntary missing persons case in 2004, 2005, etc. But it seems that the Torrington Police Department has taken it seriously by now, 17 years later. Renee Yeargain hasn't been seen since 2004. And following their mother's disappearance, three of her four children were re-entered into the foster care system. The infant at the time, Josh's son with Renee, was reportedly raised by Josh and his family. Tragically, one of Renee's older children has since passed away. The Torrington police lieutenant, who was the first investigator on Renee Yeargain's case, left law enforcement in 2008. He currently serves as a manager for the Wyoming Department of Family Services in Cheyenne. Josh Minter is presumed innocent. He has never been arrested or charged in connection with the case. He did not respond to a request to speak with me about Renee's disappearance. The case remains open today. Renee Diane Yeargain was reported missing August 13, 2004. She was 24 at the time, described as 5'8", 135 pounds. Renee is a redhead, but was also known to change her hair color often and sometimes wore wigs. She has naturally blue eyes, but was also known to wear color-altering contact lenses. She has several upper and lower body tattoos. If you have any information about Renee's disappearance, contact the Torrington Police Department at 307-532-7001. Thank you for listening to Dead and Gone in Wyoming. Sources for this episode include reporting by Denise Halbrin and the Casper Star Tribune. I want to encourage your emails and other interactions about the show. I love to hear from you. My email address is wyomingpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find me at Wyoming Podcast on Twitter. You can support the continued production of this show every month on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/wyomingpodcast or Google Dead and Gone in Wyoming Patreon to sign up. By the way, the release of this month's episode was delayed because I had written and recorded an entirely separate episode. And when I started editing the episode, I found an unfixable artifact in the recording. So I actually decided to make that full-length episode a Patreon-only episode. So that extra episode is waiting for you right now if you're able to sign up and support us on Patreon. Please share this episode with a friend, especially if they're from Torrington or if they have any connections to Torrington over the last 20 years or so. And sadly, that's all the time we have together for this month. So for everyone at County10.com, I'm Scott Fuller, already looking forward to bringing you the next episode of Dead and Gone in Wyoming.